From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. In Washington, the push by Democrats to expand voting rights has stalled. So has a major expansion of the social safety net. But President Biden did find one thing to cheer about. Today marks the 60th day since he signed his infrastructure bill into law. He announced that states would receive nearly $27 billion and tribes $825 million over the next 5 years to repair existing bridges and to build new ones.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable is here to put that news and the rest of the political week in perspective. It was a big one. Margaret Talev, Managing Editor for Politics at Axios, is here. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, great to be with you.
Good to have you. And Maya King, National Political Reporter for Politico. Maya, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this was quite a week for the president, wasn't it? Here he is yesterday after going to Capitol Hill and failing to get every Senate Democrat to support changing the filibuster rules to pass voting rights legislation.
I hope we can get this done. The honest to God answer is I don't know whether we can get this done.
And here he is talking about the raging pandemic.
I know we're all frustrated as we enter this new year. Omicron variant is causing millions of cases and record hospitalizations.
And yesterday, the Supreme Court struck down his vaccine mandate for businesses, and we again saw the highest inflation number since 1982. Maya, I don't mean to pile on there, but are these warning lights flashing for the White House?
Well, it's you have to figure out even where to begin when you think about how to solve these crises. And it's not just a warning in Washington for this administration and how they've handled these, but also on the ground now as Democrats mount their campaigns heading into the midterms. Reports today saying that Democrats are largely planning to focus on their wins from 2021 just to have things to bring to voters to get them back in office. That's a pretty bleak state of affairs when you think about it, considering these elections are 11 months away. It's a process now of just thinking about what's happening in Washington with Democrats governing, but also what they're able to bring, and if there is any room at all to make major progress between now and really the middle of the summer at the heat of these campaigns, to not only get people to support them, but to get people to vote and to participate.
Look, Margaret, this has got to be the hardest job in the world. Every administration has its challenges. Do you think that there's anything abnormally difficult about what the president is going through right now?
Well, Peter, of course. I mean, the biggest difficulty, and this would be the case whoever the president was, is COVID. It's a virus. It is an actual fact. It's not something that can be spun. It's larger than all of us, and it's mutating. And its spread is exacerbated by the fact that there is a locked-in block of Americans, a disproportionate number of whom are also Biden opponents, who do not trust the vaccine or don't believe it's necessary, won't take it, and that is kind of exacerbated the entrenchment of the virus. And so that overlays everything here that has happened in terms of health, in terms of economy, in terms of voter state of mind, whether they are Republican voters or Democratic voters or somewhere in between. But there are also the kind of systemic political problems that Biden faces, which is it's a 50-50 Senate with a couple of key senators on the Democratic side of 50 who are never going to help the Democrats do what they want to do. Yeah. So that's baked in. And then the third category is really what Biden and his team and his party are bringing to the table, which is has been some real failures both in messaging proactively and in expectation setting. And we saw that from everywhere, from the exit from Afghanistan to vaccinations and preparing people for inflation and supply chain errors. So there's very little that Biden can do to control the first two. The third is the only thing that's marginally in his control. Can he and his team get better at helping Americans to understand the context of these problems, what he's doing, and to feel good about those things?
Let's bring up the other big news this week. The president spent more than an hour at the White House last night trying to convince West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema to back rule changes that would allow voting rights legislation to pass with a simple majority. Here's Sinema. She made her position clear. Here she is on the Senate floor.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country.
Maya, there's supposed to be on Tuesday a vote for this. It seems clear what might happen, but what do you think might happen?
Well, I would agree with the folks who are essentially throwing cold water on this yet again, saying that that this won't happen because, again, he doesn't have the votes to pass this legislation outright. He doesn't have the votes. President Biden doesn't have the votes to change the rules to pass this. So it's it casts a shadow over what will take place on Tuesday and also on the president's visit to Georgia thus just this week,
Let me pose the question another way, though. How significant is it that the Senate wants to move forward when they know they won't have the votes?
It's yet another blow, I would say, to the party's prospects when it comes to being able to pass voting rights that they've put forth as marquee legislation, and kind of underlines the growing number and volume of complaints from activists, organizers, and advocates who have been saying you have to prioritize this legislation. And if you don't, not only will the voters that you need be unable to vote, but there's also this lack of enthusiasm that could take place here too. Everybody's watching what's taking place in Washington now as it relates to voting rights. This has been a big issue from the beginning when we saw these state legislatures begin to pass more restrictive voting measures on the ground. And so it's the issue isn't going anywhere, and neither, unfortunately, is this legislation as it relates to its ability to pass. And I think that this just has kind of a ripple effect, not only on the ways that lawmakers are thinking about this, but again, how advocates and folks on the ground are going to be able to respond and get their voters out in these next few months.
Margaret, building on what Maya is saying, so is this act of moving forward just as important at this point? I mean, Biden, as Maya said, risks losing significant support. Many communities see not passing voting rights legislation as a major threat to our democracy.
Yeah, it's normally not a tactic for leadership in either chamber to take up something they know is going to fail. I think in this case, they feel there's no alternative but to do that, to put a final squeeze on people, to let members who want to vote for this go on the board as doing it, to set a marker historically, and then to move on. What are they going to move on to? That's a good question. I've seen some reports that there'll be a return by both President Biden and to Democrats in Congress to some of the police reform or George Floyd related efforts. That's obviously messaging at the very least to a community that feels really frustrated with what's happened on voting rights. And then in blue states, states with Democratic governors or Democratic-controlled legislatures, all of those states, you're seeing efforts to move ahead to broaden voting rights access. It's a recognition that it's not going to happen at the federal level this year. Make it happen at the state level. The problem is a majority of states in the country are, for them, their problem is are red states, are not blue states. And so you're just seeing this further bifurcation of America. There are red states and blue states having fundamentally different laws on voting access, on access to abortions for women, on a lot of these kind of both social and also civil society kind of type of mandates and framework for what it is to live in those states. And then we're going to see Donald Trump, of course, use this moment to make his reemergence, his debut in Arizona. And that says a whole lot about the messages that he's trying to send at this moment in time.
Right. And speaking of red states, I want to get to this tape of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Wednesday. He was blasting the president for his speech in Atlanta on voting rights. McConnell said that Biden had strayed from his own promise to bring civility back to Washington.
He invoked the literal civil war and said we are on the doorstep of autocracy, talked about domestic enemies, rhetoric unbecoming of a president of the United States.
Maya, Republicans, by no means are they innocent of striking up divisions in this country, but what did you make of the point that McConnell was making there?
Well, I think that Leader McConnell essentially was speaking to a number of the grievances that those in his party have around the ways that Democrats have tried to characterize their lack of support for voting rights legislation and also the ways that they've tried to sort of recharacterize the events of January 6th. What we're seeing now, on top of all of the messaging that we've talked about coming from the White House and how those things have to change, there's almost a messaging war between both parties in Washington around just what has taken place in this country in the last year, not only as it relates to January 6th, but again, as it relates to voting rights, who gets to vote, and what is considered a quote-unquote legitimate vote in this country. And I think that what you're hearing from Leader McConnell, too, is an effort to, I think, sow the seeds of messaging on that say, you know, we're not going to be characterized as the anti-democratic party, even though many signs kind of point to that lean towards autocracy in many ways as it relates to these issues.
Yeah. Maya King is national political reporter for Politico, and Margaret Talov is managing editor for Politics at Axios. I want to thank you both for taking some time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Tanya.
There's good news in a strange place. New data measuring COVID levels in Boston's sewage show a remarkable decline. Just last month, cases of Omicron started skyrocketing to record highs. Let's bring in Gabriella Emanuel. She's health reporter with our home station, WBUR. Hi, Gabriella.
Thanks for having me.
So this graph of COVID levels in Boston's wastewater kind of looks like a church steeple. There's a sharp rise and now a steep decline. What are experts saying about this?
Yeah, so almost everyone I've spoken to has had universal enthusiasm about this. One guy, Bill Hanage, who's an epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health, he said it was unambiguously good news.
When I refreshed the website and saw it, I literally punched the air and let out a hoot because it was something which I'd been hoping for but had not been promising myself.
And these are following the trend that we've seen in South Africa and the UK, where there's about 3 weeks of incredibly rapid rise in the virus's prevalence, and then at which point it starts to kind of collapse also very rapidly. But Hanig said we actually don't know what's causing that collapse.
Let's just back up here for a moment. Tell me about scientists using wastewater as a way to measure COVID in a community. Is it more accurate than, say, tracking how many positive tests come back? What are the advantages of doing that?
Right. So throughout the pandemic, we have been looking at kind of case counts and positivity rates. But with positivity rates being so high, that's kind of an indication that case counts and such are an imperfect measure. And that's because there is a real shortage of tests. Also, a lot of people are using at-home rapid tests, and those results aren't necessarily shared with public health departments, and then they're not necessarily incorporated into kind of official numbers. So that's one issue with those case counts. The other is that people who have really mild or asymptomatic infections might not even go and get tested. So wastewater in many ways kind of is able to get around that because it's a measure that is regardless of whether you're getting tested or having symptoms, you're most likely producing it in your stool. And then this is a fairly hardy virus, so it will survive going through the sewage system all the way to the treatment plant where they can then gather samples. And what forecasters look at is not just one measure or the other, but they're hoping that all the indicators kind of point in the same direction. And one thing that wastewater is really good at is it's a leading indicator. It's one of the first things that will start to show the peak, which is what we're seeing now.
Right. And that's why you say this is an optimistic sign, but we're not out of the woods yet. Let's go back to Bill Hanig. This is the epidemiologist from Harvard who we heard from. Here's a little bit more of your conversation with him.
We still have to be worried about people who are older because the virus has mostly been transmitting among young people, you know, the 20 to 40-year-olds.
So tell me more about this cautious optimism. Like, when can we expect things to really turn around now? Do we know yet?
Yeah, that is the question. So what I am hearing is that kind of the major disruptions that are caused by people being sick or people quarantining, those should start to subside pretty quickly. But the strain on our healthcare system will probably be feeling the repercussions of this Omicron surge for at least the next month or so. Just like Hoenig said there, if we start to see that shift demographically with older people getting sick, that could lead to a burden on hospitals. It's a little unknown because there's a very high rate of vaccination and boosters here in Massachusetts, but right now, hospitals are still in the thick of it and really, really struggling under the burden of this surge.
What about other parts of the country? I'm thinking back to a conversation that I had with Houston Methodist CEO Mark Boom in December, and he was telling me that they could see evidence of community spread of Omicron in the wastewater before it became readily apparent out in the public. Are we noticing a drop-off as well in other cities when we look at the sewage?
Right, right. So what I am hearing is that up and down the East Coast, we are seeing this peak beginning to happen. Like right now, as we speak, it has already peaked in DC, but places like New York and perhaps even Rhode Island are beginning to see those peaks. The rest of the country, it seems to be about a week or two behind. I've heard kind of 7 to 10 days. And I spoke to one guy who's named Sam Scarpino. He is the managing director of pathogen surveillance at the Rockefeller Foundation.
The real question now is how fast things are going to come down. The model suggests that at least initially things will come down very quickly, but it may be that the tail is much longer than we might anticipate.
And that is actually what we're seeing in South Africa, where the pace of the decline in cases is slowing. Scarpino says we need to be very cautious about kind of declaring victory and relaxing all our precautions, because if we open too quickly, those peaks that for declining, that could just become another peak again. He said we should really hold off on relaxing everything until the hospitalization numbers go down.
Gabriella Emanuel is a health reporter with our station WBUR with a bit of good news from Boston sewage, which is not something you say every day. Gabriella, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
After 3 years without a host, ABC confirmed this week that this year's Oscars will have one. And this news has sparked a firestorm of rumors and speculation about who it could be. Also, as the awards season heats up, Squid Game is making history by scoring awards and nominations previously reserved for English language shows. And for more on this, we're joined by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. And Eric, the Oscars hasn't actually had a host for the last 3 years. Instead, the Academy has featured a variety of Hollywood figures as presenters. And that actually seemed to be working well, maybe. Why is ABC shaking things up now?
Well, that's a good question. So what happened was the executive who is in charge of ABC Entertainment and Hulu revealed that the Oscars is going to have a host. But he didn't say anything other than that. And so he said he wanted to leave a space for the show's executive producer, Will Packer, to announce what he was planning. Folks who know that name will know that Will is this really successful movie producer, particularly in making movies that feature well-known African-American stars. So he was involved with Girls Trip, for example. So I'm sure he has a lot up his sleeve to get people excited, because it would be a significant change.
The context of all of this is that the show last year only had about 10 million viewers. That is the lowest audience on record. I mean, do you think that ABC might be looking to turn that trend around? Because really, essentially, the more we talk about it, the more then people are interested in the show.
Well, you know, obviously, I do think that there's a lot of concern about the numbers for award shows, and they seem to take a precipitous dip during the pandemic. I think in part because people are more want to make up their own minds about what they think is successful or not. One of the problems I think the Oscars has is that it often honors films that people just haven't had a chance to see. The Emmys have a little better time of it because the shows they're honoring are shows that are popular with viewers. So we'll see what happens this time around. I think a few more of the movies that are in contention have been available for some time and people have had a chance to see them. So maybe they'll be more familiar with them and maybe they'll be more interested in seeing how they fare.
Okay, quickly, let's talk about your predictions for hosts this year. We know that Hollywood has been aligned with streaming platforms these days. There are lots of names that are emerging. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's been interesting to see sort of this tsunami of, you know, speculation. Tom Holland, the star of the latest Spider-Man movie, was asked about it. And at first he said he wouldn't do it. And then he came back at the end of the interview and he was like, I must have been crazy. Of course I would be willing to do it. And people were talking about that because that Spider-Man movie is one of the most successful, if not the most successful theatrical film that was released in the past year. So it might make sense to have him and Zendaya, who are already really popular anyway, to have them hosted. And then Judd Apatow suggested that only Murders in the Building star Steve Martin and Martin Short might be good hosts because they're the star of a streaming show that's really popular, but they also have a long history in film. So there's a sense that they might be like a TV comfort food in a way. And in fact, you know, Selena Gomez was their co-star on that show. She might be a bridge to younger viewers having all three of them hosts. I imagine we're going to hear relatively soon, you know, what Will Packer's plans are. But there's no shortage of people out there willing to give him suggestions.
Interesting. Okay, so Squid Games, I don't think we would call it comfort food, but it's hugely popular. It got 3 Golden Globes, many nominations for other awards, including from awards that had never been nominated for non-English shows before. This reminds me of when Parasite, also from South Korea, won Best Picture in 2020. Is this a significant moment?
I think it is because it's sort of the ultimate result of the way in which Netflix has erased the boundaries between TV industries in different countries. You know, the people who made Squid Game have been making television and film for a long time, but Americans in particular were not aware of their work because there's this weird barriers to non-English language products doing better in sort of mainstream Hollywood. And we're finally seeing that erode away, and people will become much more conversant with the giants of film and TV in other countries and some of the great work that they're doing.
Lots to watch for. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
In Louisiana, change is in the hair. Starting in June, cosmetology students will be tested on their ability to cut textured hair before receiving their license. Ambrielle Crutchfield of WPLN tells us why that matters.
The Louisiana Cosmetology Board wants anyone with kinky, coily, or wavy hair to walk into a salon and know a hairstylist can cut their hair. This shift means hair schools will have to make sure they have textured mannequin heads for teaching and learning. Edwin Neal is the chairman of the Louisiana Board of Cosmetology and the CEO of Aveda Arts.
So there's no other state that has cutting of textured hair on their state board examination.
In just about every state, requirements center on straightening hair, whether it's with chemicals or a flat iron. But growing up, Baton Rouge Aveda instructor Lauren Williams says her mother taught her the versatility of styling her hair, whether it was double strand twist, braiding, or relaxing it. This was her mother's way of instilling the value of putting her best self forward, which included appearance. In the last decade, as people have embraced their natural hair, Williams has been prepared to help her students adapt.
If you don't know something, it's intimidating until you learn it. But once you learn it, once you get it, they're like, oh, Miss Lauren, that wasn't that bad.
She says more education for her students will mean more services stylists offer. Nielsen reports that Black women are more likely to rely on salon visits, but the pandemic pushed them to be more than 2 times more likely to buy hair treatments than the average buyer. Yet Black hair hasn't been essential learning at large beauty schools like Aveda Institute until recently. The school played an integral part in pushing for Louisiana to include textured hair on the cosmetology test. Renee Goddard is the head of Aveda's texture education. From historical figures such as Madam C.J. Walker to Art Dyson more recently, Black people have taught how to care for Black hair.
It just wasn't the standard. It wasn't on anybody's state exam. We know why, because of our racist history in this country.
Historically, beauty has been an important part of power. White Europeans used social and psychological tactics to make enslaved Africans feel inferior, like deeming curly and kinky textured hair as bad. Tiffany Gill is a history professor at Rutgers University.
For the enslaved people to care for one's body became sort of an act of defiance. It became a way for them to assert their humanity and their dignity.
In hair schools throughout the country, stylists of color have picked up the slack of beauty schools and taught others how to do textured hair. For Louisiana teachers that are new to doing textured hair, they will be learning alongside their students. Nashville-based hairstylist Amber Curry graduated and taught for the Aveda Art. They now go throughout the country teaching the history of beauty discrimination and practical techniques for doing black hair. Beyond testing, they want to know what the school and larger industry will do to show it values black clients as people, like teaching diversity and inclusion, so stylists feel empowered to speak up when they see someone not receiving proper care or are being harmed.
It's not going to show if you know how to value those black bodies that you have been ignoring for however long the salon industry has been in.
Curry is concerned that Louisiana's policy change is a band-aid in the larger picture of ensuring black clients are treated with care. Aveda Arts tells NPR its curriculum does include training for students on how to consult a diverse client base. Aveda Arts is looking to change testing requirements in 10 states, including Texas. For NPR News, I'm Ambrielle Crutchfield in Nashville.
Several governmental websites in Ukraine have been hit by a cyber attack. It's not clear who is behind the hack, but it comes a week after failed diplomatic talks over Russia's standoff with NATO. Russia has stationed some 100,000 troops along its border with Ukraine, provoking fears of an invasion. Russian President Vladimir Putin wants NATO to promise not to add Ukraine to its military alliance, a demand NATO and the U.S. have refused. Joining us now is Anders Rasmussen. He was Secretary General of NATO from 2009 to 2014. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Poland's foreign minister has warned that Europe is closer to war now than it's been in 30 years. And you've written quite extensively about this in your latest article for Politico. How do you assess the risk of the current situation?
I'm very much concerned. I think there's a big risk that this situation may end up in an armed conflict. Though I don't think it's President Putin's preferred option, but it may end in an armed conflict because the demands from Russia are unacceptable. They are non-starter. And if the Russians insist on fulfilling these unacceptable demands, then it may end up in an armed conflict.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ways you see this crisis being resolved. Current NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told us yesterday on the program that diplomatic solutions are not working. And one thing you've said very strongly is that we can't negotiate under the barrel of a gun. What are the ways that you see this crisis being resolved?
I think we need a dialogue with Russia. We have a lot to speak with Russia about. We should discuss arms control and how to monitor arms control, how to make arms control much more efficient in today's world. We need to discuss disarmament. We need to discuss how we can make military exercises much more transparent. And if the Russians are ready to discuss those issues, I think this might be the way forward to ensure a peaceful solution to this. But obviously, it's unacceptable when Putin insists on having a veto when it comes to future potential NATO enlargements. He wants to dictate whether Ukraine, Georgia, and other neighbors, whether they should be allowed to join NATO. Of course, this is unacceptable. It's a non-starter.
You've said, though, that it's time for NATO to call Putin's bluff. The U.S. continues to take a tough line with Russia. Here's what America's top diplomat, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, told NPR yesterday.
We have spent weeks, months now, working in very close coordination with allies and partners at the G7,
the EU, NATO, to prepare for Russian aggression to make very clear that there'll be massive consequences if that's the path they pursue.
I want to get to what you mean when you say that it's time for NATO to call Putin's bluff. Expound on that.
I call it Putin's bluff because, in fact, Putin plays a very weak hand. He does not have support from the Russian people when it comes to a possible war against Ukraine. Economically, the Russian economy is in decline. So, in fact, Russia and Putin play a very weak hand, but he does that very skillfully. So we have to step up to the plate. We have to demonstrate firmness and unity within Europe and between Europe and the United States. And we should tell Putin that if he were to attack Ukraine, the costs will be extremely high, because we will, in that case, we will provide Ukraine with military equipment so that the Ukrainians improve their capability to defend themselves. And we will introduce crippling economic sanctions against Russia so that Russia will be isolated like Iran, Syria, North Korea, etc.
You've laid out really well the consequences of Putin's demands, but they want a promise that NATO will not expand into Ukraine or deploy weapons along its border with Russia. With NATO refusing those demands, though, is there any hope of a diplomatic solution from your view?
There will be no diplomatic solution on that topic, because obviously each and every country has an inherent right to decide its alliance affiliation itself. We cannot compromise on that. But we have a lot of other issues in which we could find a solution at the negotiation table with the Russians.
And you are hopeful for that, that that will happen, or the possibility of it will happen?
Of course. I prefer clearly a dialogue and a diplomatic solution to all this. I prefer that to an armed conflict. But I think the way to get Putin to understand that peaceful cooperation is much better than hostile confrontation, the way to convince him this is the way forward is a firm stance, because the only language that Putin respects is a language of strength, of force, and unity within Europe and between the Europeans and the US. I think one of the big prizes that Putin will pay is that if he attacks Ukraine, he might provoke an application from Finland and Sweden to join NATO. And that would be a big, big defeat for Russia.
That's former NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Astronomers are always on the hunt for new planets outside of our solar system. And now some stargazers are also looking closely for distant moons. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on the latest advance in that search.
Thousands of planets have been detected in recent years, and a lot of astronomers are focused on trying to find ones that might support life. But David Kipping says, what about moons? He's with Columbia University, and he says, in science fiction, a moon is often a great place to live.
If you've seen Avatar or Star Wars, you're probably familiar with this idea that moons in and of themselves could be habitable.
And he says, in our real-life solar system, some of the places that look the most intriguing in terms of having key life-supporting features like liquid water are moons. A few years ago, Kipping saw signs of what might be a moon in another planetary system. And now he's found a second possible moon. It's going around a Jupiter-like planet that orbits a sun-like star. They're really, really far away, over 5,000 light years.
The moon is pretty alien compared to any moon in the solar system.
For one thing, it's weirdly bigger than Earth, like 2.5 times the size.
We're not sure if it's rocky. We're not sure if it's gaseous. It's kind of in between the size of Neptune, which is gaseous, and the Earth, which is rocky.
That is, if it's really there. Scientists like Kipping can't actually see this moon or even its planet. All they can do is detect a dimming in the star as the moon and planet pass in front of it and block some of the starlight. Trying to tease out the subtle signal of a moon, sometimes called an exomoon, is pushing the limits.
You know, finding these exomoons is extremely challenging.
Marianne Limbach is a researcher at Texas A&M University, who also hunts for moons. She says this new possible one, which is described in the journal Nature Astronomy, does look interesting, but it needs to be confirmed.
Certainly, you know, I think the object, the event, does warrant further follow-up with space-based observatories.
She says there should be a lot of moons out there to find. After all, in our own solar system, moons outnumber planets. And new telescopes, like the recently launched James Webb Space Telescope, will be much more capable of finding and confirming the presence of moons, even small ones. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Commercial trucks belch tons of toxic air every day, and lately states have been trying to put the brakes on that pollution. Five states, including New York and Oregon, have followed California's lead, adopting new rules that require manufacturers to build electric heavy-duty trucks by 2025. Joining us now is Patricio Portillo. He is a transportation analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Patricio, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
It's good to have you. And California was the first state to adopt a clean truck rule in 2020. How much momentum has there been since then?
Well, clearly there's a lot of real great momentum coming from the states right now. So last year we had five states that adopted this rule. I should add that there were another 10 states as well in different phases of considering adoption as well. So I would expect us to see another handful that adopt this year.
And as a result, the states, I think it probably varies in each place, but they're saying that up to 75% of the trucks sold need to be clean or emissions free. What else do we need to know about how the rules would work?
Yeah, they ramp up over time. So there is some lead time for the manufacturers to comply with these rules. They gradually increase until they hit that 75% mark, depending on the type of vehicle. For some vehicles, like long haul trucks, for example, where electrification may not make a ton of sense, it only ramps up to 40% by the end of the rule, which is in 2035.
Well, big trucks, they kick out a lot of pollution, don't they? So what's the potential here? How much planet warming pollution can you keep out of the atmosphere?
Yeah, there's going to be a really significant impact from states adopting these rules. They're diesel burning vehicles, so they're much more closely tied to local air pollution like NOx and particulate matter. They also, like you said, they're on the roads constantly and they're constantly being utilized and they have a big greenhouse gas emission footprint.
Plus, if you happen to live near a big road or a freeway or an interstate, I imagine this might affect the way that you live in some ways.
Air pollution from transportation can exacerbate respiratory diseases. It can lead to cardiovascular diseases as well. It can take years off your life and it can lead to things like asthma and cancer. What we've seen across the country is that the majority of these communities, the ones that are sited closest to these freight corridors or freight hubs, they're predominantly low income and communities of color. So there's a big equity component as well.
I'm thinking about California, which has long been able to set its own air quality or emissions standards with the Clean Air Act. And then other states can follow California. But on this issue, do you think that a state-by-state approach to trucks will be enough to significantly change the industry?
Definitely, you know, states being kind of in this leadership position and really driving the conversation forward is absolutely vital, but it's no substitute for a federal national standard. And right now, the US EPA is developing a rule to help reduce emissions from trucks. And it's absolutely critical that they sort of match the ambition from what we're seeing in these, you know, dozen states or so.
The infrastructure bill that passed last year does have some money in there for charging stations, which all these new trucks would need. But how big is the challenge of infrastructure as you see all these states starting to ramp up their rules? Are we there yet? Are we where we need to be?
Well, what's interesting about these rules is that they're on the manufacturer. So it's a requirement to the manufacturer to produce a set amount of these vehicles, a minimum supply getting delivered to your state. And what it does is that it unlocks additional resources. So now utilities, third-party infrastructure providers, and the private sector, they see this very clear schedule that you've now outlined. And that, in turn, will allow them to begin making investments in things like charging infrastructure. Now, the infrastructure package that was passed, that's certainly going to be very helpful, but it's nowhere near enough money. We really need to see the private sector as well putting up dollars and sort of matching what the public sector is doing.
Speaking of the private sector, the trucking industry is pushing back here. They don't want the new rules because their point is that they're already investing in this kind of technology. And on the other hand, you have companies like Pepsi and Walmart. Both companies have tons of trucks, big fleets. They've pushed for federal policies to get the industry down to zero emissions. What's your feeling about, you know, where corporate America is on all this?
So there's like, you know, a dozen global truck manufacturers. They've said that they're committed to zero emission vehicles, but we really haven't seen them bring models to market the way we would have expected, especially since we see all this pent-up demand to actually buy them. And the pent-up demand, in part, it may be because they care to some extent about the environment, but it's also really because they care about their bottom line. It helps them save money on fueling and maintenance. So that's why we're seeing all of these pre-orders, like literally billions of dollars in pre-orders from fleets like Amazon, FedEx, even the U.S. Postal Service to purchase these vehicles, but they're not available. And that's also led to this rise of new zero-emission vehicle manufacturers. And what these rules that the states have adopted does, it ensures that everyone is making investments to actually produce the vehicles and allow the fleets to purchase them.
Patricio Portillo is a transportation analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now.